Welcome to The New Neighborhood. We're excited to highlight innovative early childhood work taking place in communities across the country.
In each episode, we'll be talking to people who are reinforcing a sense of community, supporting young children and their families, and focusing on equity right from the start to create a generation where all children and their families thrive. I'm Sanaa Sharif.
And I'm Kaylin O'Connor, and we're your co-hosts for The New Neighborhood.
Today, we will be interviewing Susie Diaz from Heritage University and Lucy Smartlowit from Peacekeepers Society. I like the sound of that. Both in Yakima Valley, Washington. Can you briefly introduce yourselves and your organizations?
Hi, happy to be here with all of you today. My name is Susie Diaz, the Collective Impact Director at Heritage University for Yakima Valley, Partners for Education.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lucy Smartlett, and I am the Interim Executive Director of Peacekeeper Society.
Great. And as we were preparing for today, Susie mentioned land acknowledgments and the importance of recognizing the people who originally occupied the land that we now live on. For myself, I'm in a place currently known as Madison, Wisconsin, the home of the Ho-Chunk people, who call it Tjop or Four Lakes. Happy to be thinking today about the current needs of Indigenous people, specifically in the Yakima Valley and communities there, which is really what we're talking about today.
I am currently in Guilford County, which is the native land of the Kiawe, the Sisapaha, the Okanichi, and the Shira tribes. And I recently learned that my native tribe is Indigenous to the entire Southeast region. The entire episode resonates with me in a very deep way, and I just encourage you all to do some digging. Never know what you'll find.
So I'm going to start by asking Susie, can you tell us about the population that you serve in Yakima Valley?
Yakima Valley is centrally located in the state of Washington on the homelands of the Confederate bands and tribes of the Yakima Nation. Based on the current census, we have an estimated population of about 258,000 or so people. The area we do our work in is largely agricultural. Farm worker labor throughout history has been a primary driver of our local economy.
Great, thank you. And then can you tell us about the Collective Impact Initiative that you coordinate? I'm, of course, particularly curious about what that work looks like for early childhood in your rural agricultural area.
Heritage University is centrally located within the county, and we have a short history. We're only about 40 years old. And so we understand what it means to do the work of higher education in rural context and operate on the Yakima Nation within the tribal property lines. And we were already doing some cross-sector work, recognizing that education is both a primary indicator of economic growth for people, but also a social determinant of health. And so we began our conversation with a primary partner and funder, Save the Children, back in 2018. And so together, we held these local place-based conversations where we had conversations within our community. We surveyed the people that were part of those conversations around who they'd like to partner. And as a result, Yakima Valley Partners for Education was formed. And so it's known locally as a Collective Impact Cradle to Career Initiative. We launched a month before the pandemic. And so if you can imagine, February 2020, a group of us met in Grandview, Washington, and a month later, the pandemic happened. And so we made a wise and courageous decision at the time to continue to push forward. And so a group of local leaders and people who remained very dedicated to children and family decided to push ahead. And so we became a vital support system for kids, schools, and families, and to each other. Just recalling the ups and downs of 2020 to present day. Save the Children is a primary funder and partner. We also receive support from Partners for Rural Impact, Strive Together, providing us with technical assistance, training and support that continues now without a diminishment of hope or commitment or vision of what it would take to do this cross-sector cradle-to-career work for kids and families. And so to present day, we have an active cross-district, but we're actively with three districts, so three cities, and a county-wide approach. And we've been seeing some great progress. And it's taken us a lot of collective energy, if you will, to continue to do this work under these circumstances.
Absolutely. I'm impressed that you launched right at that time and were still able to put things in motion that really helped people during the pandemic and beyond. Can you talk about how you came to focus on food security as a collective group?
Yeah, so we had done some initial work around looking at what we call data indicators, things like kinder readiness scores, third grade reading scores, free and reduced lunch, among other indicators. And we asked ourselves the big question, what could possibly be contributing to these scores? They are not at the level that we would like children to be thriving in, if you will. So these scores tend to be below threshold. And it sort of gives us an indicator that a lot of kids are being left behind. And so we're trying to answer that big question. And so we looked at potential factors, like what might be contributing to these outcomes. And children are coming to school with hunger. Could they learn? And so those were some of the questions we asked. And we looked at potential, you know, food insecurity, digital connectivity needs, parent and family engagement, a need for partnerships and resources. And we recognized that resources need to be placed in a localized manner to facilitate access for families, especially in rural communities where there are already geographic barriers on top of the transactional burdens that people have to overcome in order to access these resources. So we looked at some of these indicators and decided to use some of these resources to purchase grocery gift cards. And we began asking families what their experience with hunger or food insecurity was. And they, through surveys and conversations and our interactions, indicated regularly that they may have access and money and resources for food, let's say at the beginning of the month. But they seem to indicate that there's a shoestring budget component and that the food doesn't last for the entirety of the month, and that at some point they need to make decisions for low-cost budget type of foods for their families. So we kept seeing this over and over again, where families were indicating that the food wasn't lasting the whole month. Sometimes they lack resources. Sometimes the food pantry didn't operate at a time that they were available. We're a primary agricultural industry. And so when food banks operate locally, isn't usually at a time where families can, you know, take the time off work and access those resources. And so that just kept showing up. And that's part of how we landed there. And we're still doing some of that work. And we keep seeing a need for food.
Thank you for sharing that, Susie. I totally know what you mean about that constant need for food, especially with growing children who spent a lot of time indoors and needed to eat a lot more and, you know, have grown because of it. So we just heard from Susie Diaz, and I encourage you to study the show notes and take a look at what's going on out there. This is impactful work, and I think you should look in. Lucy, can you tell us about the outcomes you would like to see in Yakima Valley?
Sure. I think that's actually a great question. So this is something that I had to think about, and building upon Susie's response is definitely continuing to gather the data, but also continue building our partner relationships within the Lower Valley. And ultimately, I would just like to see that everyone has access to fresh food in our area, and that this is something that continues to be sustainable for our community.
Those are some tangible outcomes, and I'm just excited to see what happens from the work of both of you ladies. So I'd like to know if you could describe in a nutshell what the Peacekeeper Society is all about.
Sure. So we are an Indigenous-led nonprofit organization. We primarily serve the Yakima Reservation community or the tribal community. However, we are inclusive and we provide emergency response services such as providing food to anybody who needs food within our area. And then we also have a couple of different programs that we provide in the community itself. We have some community people trained as grief recovery specialists. And then right now we're in the process of training some people in traditional food preservation. So those are a couple of the programs that we have happening at this moment.
You know, the grief recovery really resonates, and it's interesting to hear you add that on to the services you already provide. I think that's really awesome. How long have you been doing this work and how has it evolved?
So I personally have been with Peacekeepers since 2020, and I really had the opportunity to see it evolve from working and focusing within the Yakima Valley to actually expanding out into the Pacific Northwest. We became intertribal, so to speak, and that was really a beautiful thing to be able to see during COVID, because sometimes nonprofits have more flexibility than other tribal or government-driven programs. And so we really just had the ability to communicate with another nation and ask them, what do you need and how can we provide that? And then even include, you know, volunteers from their community to come and help us. So that was really something that I want to keep up with as far as like, evolving. But right now I'm just trying to keep our organization focused within the Yakima Valley, and then eventually we'll expand out to the Pacific Northwest again when we settle down and figure out what we're doing.
Can you tell us in detail about the food distribution and what that looks like?
Sure. So we have some community partners here that actually provides us with fresh food boxes when the state of Washington has the funding available to be able to create those. So we place an order for like 350 or some. My team is an amazing team. We have a small box truck. They go and they pick that up. And then we identify an area. Typically, it's been Hera Park. So we get set up there. We have tents. We have a number of non-perishable items that we will have available to sort through and then make individual bags to provide with the fresh food boxes. And sometimes we have anywhere from 40 volunteers. And then when we have a small crew, it could just be like the eight of us. And we're managing traffic where we have runners that provide the food to the vehicles. And then we have people who actually take the data itself. So we're just asking them like what zip code they're from, you know, how many families that they're picking up for, just because we simply try to accommodate everybody that's in the vehicle, especially with gas prices increasing. You know, we want to be able to ensure that people are able to get access to food. So one thing that Susie had brought up that I really appreciated is just in mentioning one time she had gone to a food distribution with us, and she said, you know, people don't line up at 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning because they don't have anything else to do on a Saturday. Like, you know, the bottom line is that they really need food. And sometimes when you're caught up in the logistics, it's hard to remember that, especially when people are like, I've been here so long. When are you guys going to start? You know, 1 o'clock is too late. So those types of things. But for the most part, what we do is we have them go through with their vehicles. We have people bringing the food to their cars, and then we have them go on their way. So that's what our drive-through food distributions look like in a nutshell.
There's a similar service here in Guilford County. I think that it really is beneficial to lots of families to have that model available. So what can you tell us about how your approach is responsive to the mindset and culture of the communities you serve?
Our aspiration is actually to meet the community where they're at. And we are very deliberate about the locations that we pick for our food distributions. So we want to make sure that we're rotating throughout various areas within the Lower Valley because it is such a vast place. And the other part of that too is, as I had previously mentioned, typically people show up and there's four or five families in that vehicle that are either sitting in the vehicle or they're going to pick up for others within their community. We have people that are willing to deliver to our elders, which is really great. And so we just try to accommodate them with as many boxes as we can. As far as the food piece goes and even incorporating some of the cultural pieces into it, what eventually we would like to do is get to a point where we can start providing cultural foods such as salmon is a big staple, or, you know, something like to that effect, like berries or maybe even huckleberry jam type of thing. But we're right now, we're just not at that capacity to be able to provide that. So, but that is something that we are striving to do. So I think I'd have to say it's just an ongoing work in progress.
You know, I'm impressed with that flexibility of however many families and households you're picking up for, because I think often we have these sort of bureaucratic systems that say like one family can pick up one box or whatever the allotted amount is. And so to recognize that people are living in community, they're going to drop off food for the elders or for the family next door that couldn't get there today. And I think that's respectful of how people live, and particularly in communities that are more communal minded, it wouldn't make any sense to put those bureaucratic limits on. So I really appreciate that.
I was just going to say really quickly too, just in regards to our data, you know, we don't request for any type of identification. So sometimes when we've had people come through, they'd be apprehensive about sharing any information with us because they didn't know if it would conflict with some of the other benefits that they already receive. And so again, just to emphasize the, you know, the inclusivity, we provide food to anybody that's in need regardless. So that's what I really appreciate about our organization.
I truly think, believe, know that it speaks to the benefit of the intertribal connectivity. It speaks to the strength and the spirit of the intertribal connectivity. And that is really awesome work. It's really awesome to hear as well. So we like to end each episode by asking, what do you think the secret sauce is to making the community a great place to raise a child? So I'm going to ask you first, Lucy, and then you'll pass it over to Susie.
I feel like this was kind of a tough question for me to answer, but I think it's the richness of diversity and exposure to culture and community that really makes it rewarding to raise a child in, especially when they're exposed to a variety of people and cultural practices and whatnot. Now it's Susie's turn.
Seeing love in action, the love for the place, the community, the culture, the language, and caring for other people in community.
That's beautiful. I love that. I want to thank you both, Susie and Lucy, for joining us today, for sharing the great work that you're doing in Yakima Valley, and also thank our partners at Save the Children for connecting us, telling us about your work, and helping us find you to be guests on the podcast. And thanks everyone else for listening to The New Neighborhood. Be sure to check the show notes for links and additional information about some of the things we've talked about today. And please join us next time for more insights into how communities are coming together to create new neighborhoods and support early learning and development. This limited series podcast is a production of the Center for the Study of Social Policy. For more information or to contact us, visit us online at www.cssp.org.